listening to Saturday with Ted on News Talk 1010.
Yeah, you know what? Bill King's just showing off in front of our guests because he's in the music industry. Good stuff.
Bill King.
Yeah. Jerry Young, 40-year veteran in this wacky world of music as a concert promoter, a producer for years with Polygram Records, owns his own management company now. He's responsible for bringing you the great Canadian bands Martha and the Muffins and the Parachute Club, and has written a book called Pop Goes the Weasel, Rock and Roll Off the Record, and it's filled with the kinds of stories that you would imagine exist in the world of rock and roll, and only in the world of rock and roll. Nice to see you again. I haven't seen you for, I don't know, decades.
I haven't seen you for about 20 years, Ted. Great to see you.
Since I used to spin Wex.
That's true.
It is true.
Down the street of Bloor and Young.
That's right. That's right. Now, I got it. It's a lot of fun. The book's a lot of fun. And there's some great insight in here. But some of the stories, it's just, right off the top, the first story, the story of Johnny Winter. This was your first gig as a concert promoter in Montreal. At the time when that market was dominated by a guy named Donald, K. Donald.
Correct.
And he was the promoter. Any act of any real meaning that came into Montreal flowed through his office.
Donald had basically a lock on the city in terms of bringing bands into town. He had a lock on the theaters. The only theater he didn't have a lock on, which is where we turned out to bring Johnny Winter in, was the Place des Arts, because it wasn't known as a rock and roll theater. It was for ballet and things like that. But I went in there, and because it was the only venue really available for the students to look at outside of the school, and we wanted a downtown location, so I went in and sort of soft-soaped the idea that Johnny Winter was just a folk rock act, and there wouldn't be much happening, and it would be a quiet evening for all concerned. And the guy took my word for it, and the rest turned out to be history, so they say, as the seats were torn out by the raucous fans, and Johnny almost didn't make it to the gig because he was a bit smacked out on heroin, and but it all turned out great, except that I lost all the profit we'd made because I hadn't gotten insurance for the hall, being a student promoter, not knowing too much, and so we basically broke even, but it was a fun night.
The good news is it was a great success. I mean, you had great reviews in the paper, not only for the show.
It was a sold-out show, and Donald K. Donald was a bit steamed about it, I understand.
Yeah, and the papers, well, and part of the reason would be because the papers are writing about, oh, who's this upstart college kid who comes in and pulls the wool over, or the blanket over Donald K. Donald's eyes and pulls off the show in a venue that he has no control over that's never been used for rock and roll. It's a sold-out show. The performance is great. The problem is you had to pay for all the damage because you didn't have the foresight to buy insurance.
Not too bright.
What? It was your first gig.
It was my first gig. And the kind man who, of course, was booking the hall for Place des Arts, of course, didn't tell me that I could get insurance. If I'd actually known about insurance, I probably would have said, yeah, maybe something could happen, but it never crossed my mind.
Yeah. You know, you talk about the great success of, when I was reading the book, I'm reading about the Parachute Club. And of course, the big hit of theirs was Rise Up. And the last time I heard that song performed was at
Jack Layton's funeral.
And I wanted to get what were your thoughts on that? Because when I heard it, I understood why they played it. I understood, you know, that he was a big fan of the band, and it's very popular. It was a celebration of life. To me, just the title itself, and I mean this with complete reverence, seemed a little awkward. Rise Up. As in resurrection, rise up.
I understand where you're coming from on that. I of course, have nothing to do with
what was going on with that.
And here's the situation. My understanding is that Lorraine Segato, the lead singer of the Parachute Club, was a great friend of the Laytons and saw them frequently and supported their political causes, et cetera, et cetera. And I think when he died, I think Olivia Chow came and asked Lorraine if she would do that. And Lorraine, I think, probably said absolutely, what your wish is.
I mean, I think it worked beautifully and everything. Maybe it's just my sort of peculiar
mind. You know, I certainly, a lot of people got in touch with me afterwards and said, hey, this is really something. Most people seemed quite excited about the fact in terms of my relationship to the song that, oh, geez, weren't you impressed that Rise Up was used at Jacqueline's funeral? You know, I to me, it's not really here or there. It seems to be. It was like a wish of his widow, and
I'm glad it happened. I'm sure for the entire family, it was a terrific moment.
It was probably closing a circle to some degree for them.
You had some difficulty signing them originally because at the time you were looking at what $100,000 to produce an album.
Well, what happened was that I've managed Martha Muffet's.
Because they had written one song at that point.
Well, yeah, like what happened was I'd formed a record company with two entertainment lawyers, Joe Fedora and another, Brian Keevil. And we formed Current Records and Management and signed Martha and the Muffins, and they went on, had Echo Beach, big hits, and had a great worldwide deal with RCA. I then went to, thanks to Richard O'Brien, who used to own the Bamboo Club here in Toronto.
Yeah, what a great place.
He's an old friend of mine from the Etobicoke days back when I was a teenager. And he said to me, Jerry, you know, you've got Martha and the Muffins. I've got a great band of appearing at one of my booze cans tonight at 3 a.m. Why don't you come over? And I said, 3 a.m, I don't know if I can handle this. So he said, no, come on, it's worth it. So Danny Lanois and he was producing Martha Muffins album at that point. We were in Hamilton, so I said, Danny, do you want to come see this band Richard O'Brien's turned me on to called the Parachute Club? He said, yeah, why not? So he came with me, and we went to this old warehouse over around Liberty Street and got in there, and there was like a big empty warehouse except a little stage set up and a couple of bars, of course. And finally this band came on, and they were absolutely fantastic. They had some great dance moves. They were full of beats and everything else, but it was all cover songs. But songs that were cover songs that were done like you hadn't heard them arranged before. And mm-hmm. So I was excited and interested. And then somewhere along the performance, about a 45-minute performance, probably around 3:45 a.m, one song came on that sounded just fantastic, and it was original. I knew I hadn't heard it before. And afterwards, I went up to the band. Saw the band there, and I said, Lorraine, Billy, I've never met you before. My name is Jerry Young. Are you interested in signing a record deal? And they said, a record deal? We don't even write any of our songs. And I said, well, excuse me, that one song in there, Alienation? I said, that was your song, isn't it? They said, well, hey, actually, that's the one song we've had a chance to put together. I said, well, if you can write that one, you can write a bunch more. And, in fact, they turned out to do Rise Up in the first album after they went away to Antigua with some of my advance money that I'd given them, and they wrote the album.
And where did they go from there? Like, they seemed to, they looked like they were climbing, and then suddenly hit a ceiling.
Well, basically, the situation, the money is a big factor of how things work in the record business, as you well know. And the first album cost my partners and I $90,000. And that was great. The band only got about $15,000 or $20,000 between seven of them, because the rest went to the production of the album with Daniel Lanois and his studio. But then, you know, because of the success of the first album, of course, the second album, budgets go higher. Yep. And now we're up to $150,000 for the second album. And, of course, they're getting a larger chunk than that. And then, of course, there's the publishing revenue coming in from all the writing. And, of course, that's when it also gets sticky with a band about, well, wait a second, here's new money coming in from a song that we all wrote. And, of course, they're all remembering now who wrote what. And so there are various meetings now being held about who wrote what. And this is all different than how it all starts. Finally, when the third album came down, they had a hit, by the way, with the second album, and a platinum album with The Feet of the Moon. Then the third album came down with John Oates involved, and now we're up to $250,000 for the album. And we're recording in New York City at the Electric Ladyland Studios. So it all gets to that. Finally, what happened was that it came to a flux. People were leaving the band because they weren't getting what they wanted out of the band.
Yeah.
And that became various musicians, and eventually I got turf myself.
You get to a point where you're too successful for your own good, I guess. Yeah,
apparently.
All right. The book's called Pop Goes the Weasel, Rock and Roll Off the Record, the author Jerry Young. When we come back, we're going to talk about a number of different acts that you've worked with and promoted over the years, including some interesting stories about Frank Zappa. That's all coming up at 11:46 at News Talk 1010. Let's check Time Saver Traffic.
It's Saturday with Ted on In Depth Radio. News Talk 1010.
11:52 at News Talk 1010. Welcome back to the program. Pop Goes the Weasel. It's a fascinating book. Rock and Roll Off the Record. The author, Jerry Young, 40-year veteran, concert promoter, manager. For years with PolyGram. How many years with PolyGram?
I was with PolyGram for 3 years until Martha the Muffins asked me to quit and manage them.
Do you regret that?
Which I did, and I'm happy I did.
And then you've got your own company, Current Records.
That's right.
Well, how many bands are you representing now?
I represent
groups.
Six bands right now that I manage, and I also do consulting work for another five or six.
And what kind of bands are they?
All ranges. I got everything from pop to rock to country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Handle it all. I like all kinds of music. If it's got a good melody and a good beat, I'm into it.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I have a son who plays in a, well, I guess it's kind of a punk band, I guess you could say.
Right.
But, and I quite enjoy a lot of their music.
Absolutely.
And they're getting better and better and more polished.
Yeah. The one problem I've always had in any kind of music, I guess, was heavy thrash metal. I'd never actually heard a melody. I've heard the beat, but I've never heard a melody, and I always like the melody part of a song.
Frank Zappa was one of those innovative musicians, unfortunately died a number of years ago, and outspoken, to say the least. And you recall in your book a story about him dropping by to promote, was he in town for a concert? Or was
he was in town for a concert, actually, yeah.
And so he was over at Chum FM, and the guy who was on the air at the time was Rick Moranis,
correct.
Same guy from Bob and Doug McKenzie from SCTV. He was a disc jockey for a number of years. And he got seriously insulted, Zappa did, by what they had done to one of his albums. Continue that story.
Well, the program director at the time was a fellow by the name of J. Robert Wood at Chum.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob had a lot of rules that he sort of made his staff run by, and also the station. And he had supreme authority over that station, which at the time was the number one pop music station in the country. And one of the rules he had was he didn't like any profanities or anything that smacked of anything to do with rough and tough, so to speak, in terms of music. And Frank came in for an interview, and Rick Moranis was on the air. And Rick, of course, as he's wont to do, like any DJ is wont to do, is while an artist is there, is going to play some of the music of the artist who's visiting and chatting. Mm-hmm. And he said to Frank, what we plan to do here is put on a couple of tracks. And Frank said, that's great. He said, I'm thinking of playing this and this. And Frank said, just a second, let me see the record you've got there that you're about to put on. And Rick said, sure. And he handed him the record. And he said, well, why have you got some of these tracks taped?
As in masking tape over the actual
track on the album. And he said, well, our program director, Bob Wood, said those are tracks we can't play on the radio because they're provocative and sexually explicit. So Frank, of course, didn't like this, but he got his revenge the next night. And what happened was the next night he'd gone out. Of course, in the round of interviews, we after the Chum interview.
Well, he went on a tirade on the air about Chum of him on the air.
Well, he did on the air. He got into how it was undemocratic for his music to be screwed with like this. That in fact, if he'd known this, he wouldn't have come to the station and done the interview in the first place. Of course, at that point, I started getting from everybody. It's because I hadn't informed Frank. But frankly, I didn't even know that this had happened. I assumed that Bob was just not playing. I didn't think he'd mask the tape some of the album. At any rate, Frank went absolutely nuts on the air, and poor Rick was just left helpless and apologetic. And
so then you take him over to CFNY, which I guess is the Edge now.
It's called Edge,
right?
102 now, but it was CFNY 102.1, and they had a little station in Brampton.
They weren't
downtown.
I worked there.
Well, it was that little yellow building in Brampton.
Yes, sir.
And I think it was Highway 10. I'm not sure. At any rate, we took him out there, and it was about a 45-minute drive out of the city, and we got out there. And, of course, they were thrilled to have anybody at all who would make the 45-minute drive out to Brampton at that time to be interviewed, and Frank Zappa in particular, who is such a big star. So the people at NY were just over the moon about having him at the station, and everybody wanted to come up and meet him. And of course, CFNY was a sort of a rebellious station. Of course, they didn't put tape over any tracks. They played whatever they felt like, including anything sexually explicit. And of course, this was Frank's kind of station. So suddenly, Frank's being inundated with t-shirts, buttons, pins, coffee cups of NY product, CFNY product. And, of course, the next night, Frank had his master plan in action, which was the night of the show, which Chum FM was promoting at Maple Leaf Gardens, in front of 17,000 people. Frank came out, and all his roadies came out wearing CFNY T-shirts, even
gotcha.
Though it was a Chum FM production.
Gotcha. That's a funny story. Time is fleeting so rapidly here. What I do want to ask you, though, is if talk to me a little bit on oversight into how much different the industry is now and the industry is today in terms of why and how records are done with the, you know, and downloading. And it seems to me that a lot of artists are willing to give their music away if they can just so they can attract you to spend the money to come see them in concert.
That's absolutely true. The live things now are ultra important, again, because the revenue streams from selling records is so diminished.
Mm-hmm.
And so few people actually get record deals now. Things have changed so drastically because of the internet. Even now, Ted, if I want to shop a band to get a record deal, which some say is not even worth the effort anymore, because record companies aren't signing so few people. You don't shop them now handing in the CDs to the A&R people anymore, the artist and repertoire people. You simply email them a link where they can go and listen, if they feel like it,
yeah.
to the artist. They can look over the bio, they can see a video, and then they can make a decision if they want to sign it or not. But of course, as we know, the record business is in worse trouble than the artists are these days.
Yeah.
So things have changed drastically.
So the whole deal now is, it's like, you know, if you think you're going to sell, you know, millions of CDs and sit at home and watch the money pour in, good luck to you. If you're going to make any of the money, you're going to be on the road.
Yeah, that party's over in terms of that selling records in the mega millions anymore. I think it comes down to now finding your own niche. And, you know, you build on a base. And bands now are going in, and you don't have to get a $100,000 studio anymore. You can actually do it at home with your own equipment. For $20,000, $30,000, you can have a great record, international record.
Yeah, it's amazing because I know even, I mean, again, you know, I'm going to sit here and talk about my son all afternoon, but listening to what he's done and some friends of his and other bands, and they've gone to producers and for a lot less money than that have produced good quality CDs.
Absolutely. Things have changed for the better in that way.
Yeah. It's a great book. There's a lot of great stories in here, wonderful insight. I appreciate you coming by. It is good to see you after all these years.
My pleasure, Ted. Thank you.
Jerry Young, author of Pop Goes the Weasel, Rock and Roll Off the Record. Where is this available? Is it on
Amazon.com.
Amazon.com. There you go. And Jerry doesn't make a penny selling this. He just wants you to come watch him speak someday.